Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is Jason Pommenthal. Jason, hello.
Hey there.
I'm going to talk a little bit about you, and then you can, and then we'll have a conversation. How's that sound for a plan?
Sounds like a good plan. Okay. I'm okay with that.
Okay, so Jason works for himself designer who has had a love affair with type all his life and got involved in the web industry in 1994, which is really pretty much any earlier and you were Tim Berners-Lee.
Well, no, any earlier I would be Jen Robbins or Tim Berners-Lee.
There you go. That's correct.
Because she definitely predates me on the web.
Because she had already written a book about it in 1994.
That's correct. She probably has.
That's right. Here are the time-tested... Yes. And she did that when she was 12 years old also. She's a remarkable human. But
she is. I owe a lot to her. She's awesome.
As do we all. Hers was the first book about HTML that I read, and it made sense, which was... very lucky for me. I could have gone down any number of bad paths. So thank you, Jen. Jason has had his love affair with type stymied by the likes of Font Tags, Cipher, and how did we say it? Qfon? I forget. It's so long ago.
Whatever it was, followed by a bunch of expletives.
I mean, all those things were necessary. They were wonderful inventions. They were wonderful hacks. But then came a Found Face, and then Jeff Veen said, "Let there be Typekit." And since then, let's not forget also Hokum Lee, who said, "Let there be Font Face."
Right.
Then Jeff Veen said, "Let's do something practical about that." And here you are working with responsive type. In fact, you're the author of Responsive Typography from O'Reilly, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you just come out with that book?
No, actually, I wrote that. It was published in 2014. For the size of the book, I started it far too long prior to that, probably about 2 years prior to that. So, I mean, I started using Typekit when it was in beta. I got an invite from a wonderful fellow named John Cianci, who actually still works at Oomph, which is the agency where my wife works. And that was just a match that just totally reinvented my love of working on the web. And I've been really focused on using type on the web since then, writing about it, speaking about it, researching it, playing with it.
You've written for Net Magazine, Print Magazine, How, Typecast Blog, Fonts.com, pretty much everyone but Alyssa Part, which makes me sad, but we could fix that.
We can.
And you've been on every podcast but this one, I think. It's good to
like
have
it
you.
Sometimes, so thank you.
It's good to have you. First of all, I want to talk about the book. We're going to want to talk about responsive typography and what that means now. And the new typography. But let's start by asking a practical down-to-earth question. You are a self-employed designer, and you do typographic design, typographic experiments, workshops. What does the day look like for you? Somebody who's saying, I want to quit my job and do what he's doing, what does that look like?
It's definitely evolving, over the last 24 years, I've worked for myself a bunch of times. I've worked for other companies. I've had my own company at a couple of points in time, and at this time I tried to be more intentional. I've tried to learn a little bit more from, you know, reading and following people like Dan Moll, and tried to Jonathan Stark, I read his emails pretty much every day, and this time around I tried to think about what is the work that I wanted to be doing. Because I've been doing this long enough, I know I can get work. Getting work or getting a job isn't the problem. It's getting work that I really want to be focusing on. And right now, I really want to be focusing on helping companies use type and use design systems better. So I kind of expanded it a little bit. I really originally decided I wanted to try and focus solely on variable fonts, but it's just not, there's not a, quite enough, but it fits in the realm of design systems. So
variable fonts, I mean, as a point of difference, it's a good feather in your cap, I would say, right? It may not be this year something that you can entirely circle the business on, but it's definitely, you know, if there's 20 other people saying we do design systems, you can say we do design systems with responsive typography with variable fonts.
That's yes.
Huge. That's huge. And here's what it means for performance, and here's what it means
right.
in terms of graphic design. Because when you started talking, and then I'm going to turn it back over to you, but when you started talking, you said, well, I help companies with typography and branding. And I said, I was thinking, that kind of sounds like a graphic designer's job. And you are that, but you're also something else, right? Because this is now.
Yeah. And that's a really big part of what I'm trying to incorporate in my talks and my workshops. Because the people that, like, if we look at the whole world of designers, you know, there's a broad spectrum. The ones who know the most about type are generally graphic designers who studied graphic design, because typography is always a part of that education. And people that go through UX boot camps rarely get any typographic education, and that saddens me. So one of the things that I set out to do with my book and my talks and my workshops is to create ways to give some of that typographic history and understanding to people who are much more familiar with other aspects of design, user experience, front-end development, and may not have the benefit of some of that history. And what is it that makes something readable? What is it that gives voice to a brand or to content? And kind of help them, introduce them to that a little bit. Because I think that's a real gap in our industry, and it's something that I really would like to try and address.
When UX first came out, when some of us, some of our peers first started describing themselves as UX designers, I cynically and falsely, and I apologize in advance, I know this will be offensive, but I thought, so that's a designer that only knows one font, Helvetica. Because a lot of the people that described themselves that way, they were really good at like wireframing and, you know, and using sort of the razorfish system of, you know, every point was like 0.1A. Like the thing that Google Docs will do for you if you wanted to automatically, they would do it manually. Like this is concept 0.1.A and then 0.1.B. They were really very... And it made it look all scientific and everything. And I was like, but that's in part because you're not real into typography and color and shape and white space and all those things. Like, I had a prejudice against it because I personally I feel kind of mediocre at everything. But I would know, like you know, you're not like, say this designer who's amazing with color and typography. And so this was a good career choice for you.
Right.
And then I started realizing... There's actually this huge spectrum of what design is.
Yeah, well, I stole Paul Boag's phrase a while ago, and I usually tell people that I specialize in being a generalist.
Nice.
And I do sort of stick to that, in that I've done lots of traditional graphic design. I've worked in web design and web development for, well, since Mosaic and Netscape One.
Right.
And I've done a fair amount of fairly intensive back-end development and server stuff as well. Thankfully, I don't really have to do that anymore. But But so I have a good understanding of the whole spectrum, and I think that that definitely informs my work as a designer. And I've just been trying to focus again more on the typography, tone, voice, what that does for a brand, and then what, you know, how can we make that more central to user experience as a whole and incorporate that within a design system, which, you know, it all kind of goes together pretty nicely.
What's your favorite part of the job?
You know, that's really, it's kind of hard to say. I felt tremendous satisfaction in launching the redesign of my own site, because I felt like...
With one font.
I did use another one for some accents for some of the UI elements, but generally speaking, yes, it's just using Roslindale from David Jonathan Ross from his Font of the Month Club, and he made a variable version of it that can go from a nice text face up to this really beautiful condensed display that really looks, to me, just gorgeous at really large scale sizes. So I built a whole typographic system around that and really tried to make that the visual element of the site.
And it is. Did you consult with DJR?
We've been working together with variable font stuff almost since they came out in 2016. He's been one of the people, along with CJ Dunn, that have kind of supplied me with variable fonts to play with and use in my talks and experiments and research since the very beginning. So he and I talk often, and I showed him a little preview of this as I was starting to get it ready, because while I don't think he would consider it a production ready release, I felt like it had everything that I needed to do this redesign, and I wanted to really showcase what you can do, and so that was the differentiator, is that this is all with I think it's about a 60K font file, as opposed to, you know, having five or six different font files of several hundred K to do it without the variable font. So
you also made the decision to limit your color palette, like, radically.
I did.
So there's a slightly tan gray. I don't know what it is. It's nice. I wouldn't know how to describe it. And it's probably, you know, it's different on my monitor than on yours, but it's lovely.
A warm gray. That's sort
warm
of what
gray.
I was,
right.
was going after.
And sticking with the warm, there's a sort of a rusty orangey brown link color, which on, there's no, is there, the hover effect is to slightly brighten it, like ever so slightly, like the minimum that you could do and a human would perceive that there was a change. And that's it. And then the only other splashes of color are like your O'Reilly book, which has some green in it because all O'Reilly books do. So, like, you know, even the book itself is equally minimalistic and you know, very restricted. And then there's just this little splash of blue-gray. Gray, you know, like cool gray at the very bottom of a graphic. And that's it, which is remarkable. But that's probably something that you teach when you teach design to people who haven't studied design. Like use as few elements as you can so people can make sense of them.
Well, I think what I wanted to do was, one, give the type and the text prominence, and then allow, like, if you look at the resources page, you'll see there's more little sort of like thumbnail images incorporated in
right.
it, and it lets those really stand out. But when it's not there, then the type can actually take up more space. And I wanted to see what I could do with the fewest number of elements possible. And so I started, I started with the type. I really just focused in on the typographic system, and then started working with layout, and then only started to add different little visual elements when I felt there was something missing. So, you know, I certainly don't consider myself the best graphic designer or visual designer or whatever you want to call it, but it was pleasing. It makes me feel good. I enjoy showing it to people. I like putting stuff there. I like using it as a showcase for variable font stuff, whether I did it or not, just trying to like add lots of resources for people. And then it's a nice home for my talks and my writing.
The utility font, that little, the one that says like Monday, 30th of July, what is that?
FF Meta.
Okay. Duh. Okay. Sorry. Now I feel very foolish. But okay.
Well, I used that one because I did some work for Monotype when they released FF Meta as a variable font, creating an essay. I wrote an essay and then kind of typeset a page in Meta. And we used that as an introduction and a demonstration of what you could do with that. With just that, again, it's a single font file, 84K for all the weights and italics. And it was just this sort of exercise in everything is about the type.
Meta, it makes perfect sense to make a variable font for Meta, right? Given the history of Meta, what it was supposed to be and how it was used back in the... I'm forgetting the name. The Adobe, that little control
multiple
panel.
Multiple masters.
Yeah, multiple masters. Yeah. And that, for people who were not born yet then or who were very young then, right, it was a little control panel on your Mac that let you basically do what we're doing now, right, in a different way. Just change the width. But variable fonts have much more flexibility than that, right? In terms of adding serifs and descenders and all kinds of things, it's really limited by the designer's imagination and the weight trade-off that they're willing to make.
Yeah, and that we're just so in the infancy of what people can do with that. So I guess we're already talking about it. I should probably give like a really short explanation of what a variable font is.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
So it does have its origins with actually multiple masters and also TrueType GX were both ways to incorporate different widths and weights and variants of a typeface in a single file versus having it all be many files. So FF Meta, for example, there are in the standard width, there are like 18 different weights available, 100 through 900 in 100 number increments, and then upright and italic. So you've got 18 different files if you wanted to use the full range of what's possible in the original design. And a variable font allows you to bring all of that into a single file by only storing the offsets of the curve points. So if you imagine an Illustrator, if you like look at a drawing of a letter and you've got points at every corner and then some points along the curve, and for the standard letter outline, you have these points in one place, and if it's really thin, there's an offset of those points to make it thinner or thicker. And so the font format stores those differences and then allows for interpolation in between them. So you can go whatever the typeface designer allows, so it's not a distortion, it's not introduced by the browser, it's whatever is exposed by the typeface designer to make it as wide or as narrow, as thick or as thin, upright, italics, slanted, somewhere in between. It allows for all different kinds of axes of variation. So
the math is alive, not dead.
Yes.
Right? In fonts before this, and traditional fonts, there's math, but it's fixed. It's done. It's like a fixed width design.
Right.
And this is like a responsive design for type, for the font itself.
Yeah. And actually, it was Nick Sherman, I think, was the first person I ran across who drew the distinction that this is actually about responsive type. Not typography, but the type itself.
Right.
Can actually, in the context of the web, it can respond to user context.
He wrote about that on a list apart 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah. I think it might have been even longer than that.
Yeah, it might have been.
And
it was way in advance of the actual stuff, because he's worked with David Berlow and people like that, and he's always had a hand in things that are coming 5 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't even conceive of how that could possibly work when I first read that article. And that's so I when I started down the path of sort of investigating responsiveness and typography, it was still with the notion of the typefaces were fixed, but the way we used them, I thought, could scale better
right
across different screen sizes.
Of course, right. The way, like in grid-based design, where you can have the headline be responsive to the containing box, for example, headline right. size, but the font isn't necessarily changing. It's not right. getting heavier or lighter, although now it can.
Right.
But a traditional,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. So when I first started writing about it, the whole idea of responsive typography was thinking through, for performance, how are you loading them so that you're not interfering with content getting on the page? What can you do to get content on the page and then style it better? What can you do to make it be in better proportion from small screen to large? On a small screen, you need the headings to be a little bit smaller so you don't end up with like one broken word per line. And so you want to think about that proportion more in the abstract, that this is more important than that, rather than it has to be three times the size. And,
right.
And so allowing, using media queries to create this sort of dynamic scale of typography was a big focus of my book.
It's really design systems in the ultimate sense of that. It doesn't mean like, here's our 20 fonts and here's our, but it's like design systems, like systematically thinking about design, right? Which responsive right. design lends itself to. In a way, when I wrote Designing with Web Standards many years ago, and I talked about rules-based design, that's what I was going for. The tools were so primitive, and my means of self-expression were primitive also, that I don't think that many people understood what I was going for. I didn't really fully explain myself. But the idea that the design might change and still be the appropriate and right, that it wasn't a fixed expression. I mean, think when we started, there was a mathematical representation of the font, which was sent to the printer, and then there were these pixelated screen fonts. Imagine we're in a world now where the fonts are rendering as math on the page, on the screen page, but the pixels, when we started, it would be like, well, this font looks good at 12 points and it looks good at 18 points. You can't set it at 14, let alone like 14.7 M's or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? You really couldn't, because it was made to look right on this screen resolution. This was not that long ago. This is our, you know.
No, it wasn't. And that's, it was really interesting. I think the process of working on my talks for Event Apart this year really got me revisiting my own thoughts about what is a good typographic system in a very different way, because even until a year ago, I was still generally thinking of these things in terms of, on a small screen, it's going to be this set of size ratios, and on a mid-size screen is going to be this one, and mid-size, and it's still, right. I was still thinking mentally in like point sizes, and what would I do in Illustrator or whatever, and then thinking, translating that over to the web. Even if I was ending up using M's, I was still thinking about these things as, this is two times the body size, this is three times the body size,
I would say it's hard to get away from that, because it was also hard to get to the web to the point where we could do that. It's hard to get to the point where you could say there's any meaningful relationship between type size and line height. And I can remember agonizing over like how many pixels of gutter I would have between a picture and like going, oh man, it's either going to look good in Explore or Netscape, and just, all these miserable, or I want the tops of this image and this text line to align, but I can never really, just like having crazy cheats, like inline styles that would cheat something up by like 3 pixels to make it not look terrible.
I think that the hardest lesson that I've had to learn as a graphic designer is where does the line of control versus suggestion come into play? And I think that's really one of the phrases that I love from Tim Brown's new book, From A Book Apart,
right,
about flexible typesetting, is he characterizes this as a suggestion. We can suggest how the type should work, or any other aspect of the design.
But that's the web.
Right, exactly. It's not always going to do that. The content's going to change. The browser's going to change. The screen's going to, someone's going to turn their phone sideways. All hell breaks loose.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
the struggle, but Jen Simmons actually gives a great talk on this, like the struggle between control and between it's art and it's the web. That's been the whole 20-year process where I was like, when I started, I was like, this is all liquid and I don't kind of control all that. And I like worked really hard to sell my clients on, we have no control and it's good that way. And then I would like go into this really super anal period where I'd be like, absolutely, I want this to look like a poster. I want this, and being seduced by different early CSS, right. Like, well, if I just use absolute positioning and font sizes and pixels, I can really make a poster on the web. Isn't that great? And it's like, yes, you can. But in this browser, it'll look terrible. And in this tiny screen, it'll look bad. And this user has told their browser to override CSS. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's that push and pull. Are we still suggesting, like Tim Brown says, then, even with responsive typography and variable fonts, are we still merely suggesting? Are we doing more than that? How should we be thinking about this?
I think it's always still going to be a suggestion because, what we need to remember is, as people like Jen Simmons, to Jeremy Keith, to like many of the people are constantly reminding us rightly that everything that we're doing as designers is an enhancement past markup. So when I started the workshop that I just taught a couple weeks ago at a conference a type conference in Belgium, we started the day looking at a web page with no style sheet and just looking at like what are the tags we use to give meaning to this content. And that's sort of the first layer of it. And then you start to add
the Google view.
Right. And what is the machine view of this? So that someone with a screen reader or some other kind of machine or like something's reading, if you're piping it out through Alexa or whatever that is, that there can be some association of relative importance. This is an H1 versus an H2 versus a paragraph. And so that's the first layer. And then you might add fonts from there to kind of give it more of a visual tone. And you're going to add CSS to play with the size relationships. But all of those things come into play at one point during the page load. Because the first thing that gets loaded is the content. And so the first thing we want to do is make sure that content gets on screen. And then the styles are going to be applied and the fonts are going to load. And at each step along the way, we want to make sure that we're providing a good experience because it might stop there. If they have Opera Mini and there's, 400 million people in the world that are using Opera Mini, they're never going to get web fonts. So your typography has to work without them just as well as it works with them. So what I try and teach is building in that stack so that you start with good markup, then you start to add styles for relative scale across different screen sizes, and then you enhance it with the type that you want to be using. So that way, at each step along the way, you can turn those things on and off and see if the design still holds together and make sure. And if you start with your own little kind of framework starting point, it doesn't necessarily add a ton of time to the overall process. So that's really what I try and focus in on, is helping people with a starting point so that they're more likely to get to those details that make sure the experience is really good for everyone.
That's a web-centric view. That's a user-centric view. That's a UX-centric view, right? The progressive enhancement. These are all enhancements. It needs to work as an experience no matter what. That's the web standards view. At the same time, there's always a tension between that and the client's view and the award-winning designer's view and the UI designer's view, which is, look at this beautiful, look at my beautiful thing on Dribbble. Look what I made. And I love that stuff. I'm not going to say, oh, that's immature, sure, or bad design. And I'll look at something and go, wow, I wish I had the skill to, like, look at the sheen they put on that little air element and how much better it makes it, or this tiny shadow, or the removal of, I would never have thought to remove that. That's so great. I look at stuff and soak up visual pleasure from it. And I'm always torn between what I know as an advocate of web standards and accessibility and usability and what my heart loves as a visual person. Do you have that? Do you find it also to be kind of, it's almost like you have happy days and sad days. You have designy days and UX days.
Yeah, I do. What I try and keep in mind is that a lot of the things that that we do are foundational, and we make those things part of our process, and there's less question. So the award-winning designer, the client, they want to see, you know, the best possible view of it. How we get to that best possible view is usually that's our problem. Oftentimes they may or may not care. But the good clients are starting to, let me rephrase that, because that's not a good way to put it.
No, that's okay. I know what you mean.
But, you know, clients who are more aware.
Clients who are more aware of the limitations of how the web really works. Right. Doesn't mean good clients in every way, just in that one way.
Right. And I try and be very mindful. I don't like the phrase bad client.
Right.
Because I usually think that means it's a designer that doesn't explain themselves very well.
Right.
And I don't want to be that guy.
Right.
So, clients that are a little bit more aware, I think.
Wait. I've had a bad client. A bad client is someone who pretends when they owe you the final payment that they didn't like the work, even though they've been using it for 3 months. That's a bad client.
Okay, yes.
Someone who's dishonest.
Yeah.
Anyone who's fundamentally dishonest in some way is a bad client. That we can say.
Yes, but I think that's fair.
But if they don't know that not everyone's going to see the same technology stack, that doesn't make them a bad client. In fact, another problem. Boy, I'm really interrupting you. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I'll shut up. You go ahead. I'll try to remember the problem later.
Well, it's what I wanted to sort of think about or talk about is, clients that are a little bit more aware will think that there's value and recognize that there's value in ensuring that it works well. I just started on a project today, right before this, had a call with the client team and their development partner and my role in it. So, you know, what does my day look like? Was talking to them about some type choices that had been made in some of the original designs and it's impacted by licensing, it's impacted by device compatibility, and we know that their internal, so it's a state digital team that what's standard for their IT infrastructure across all state agencies is one level of browser, and then there's the general public, and that's their, you know, that's also a big audience that we want to make sure we can deliver a good experience to both, and they still value the idea of providing this baseline experience that works for all of their state agencies, but might actually be better or more robust for people outside that infrastructure, who are their real clients.
Right.
You know, it's the citizens of the state that have to interact with them. So we're trying to think through how could we provide this kind of layered experience so that as each browser improves and they change their infrastructure and maybe they go from IE11 to Edge, then all of a sudden the variable fonts just start working.
Right.
And everybody gets that improved experience. When Firefox launched a couple weeks ago, version 62 with support for variable fonts, all of a sudden, the number of people seeing the message on my site, "I'm really sorry, you're not seeing the variable fonts," dropped to almost none, which was pretty awesome.
I've never seen that message. I'm so happy I've never seen that message.
But yeah, it was pretty great just to see it really work. And the Firefox team is awesome. And I've been, Jen Simmons actually helped get me involved in writing some stuff for their developer site about variable fonts. And they've just been awesome to work with. And I was just really excited to see all of that stuff go live.
They are amazing. And she's amazing. It's interesting. You had a message. Now, in the old days, we had messages like, "You need Netscape 4 to view this site." That was bad, but it's okay to make an experience that works for everyone and to say, especially if you're in the business of consulting on variable fonts, to say, "Hey, I'm sorry you're not seeing the variable font experience here." That's completely legitimate, because basically what you're saying is, "I'm a specialist and we're in a transitional period in technology. And so if you're coming here going, 'I don't know why this guy talks about this thing and I don't see the big deal, looks like Georgia to me,' like, you can explain, 'Well, yeah, you're seeing Georgia because blah, blah, blah.'"
Yeah. So what I did with that was I used the technology that we all have at our disposal. We use CSS feature detection to show and hide two different blocks of text. And so if you had support for variable fonts, it would say, "Great, you're seeing variable fonts. You could learn more about it here." And it would take you to the Colophon page with a little explanation of why this is different. And then if you were not seeing them, it would direct you to and show you a different message on that page and say, "Here's why you're not seeing it. Here's some browsers that support it. And this is a little bit more information. You can read a little bit more about it here."
Or if you had this bad client and you were evil, you could, and you knew that your client had standardized on IE11 and was not going to change for the next 20 years, you could have a site that looked perfectly good in that, but in Firefox said, "We are a bad client who don't pay our bills." Not that this has ever happened to me, and I'm not recommending that. Would be very unprofessional. I'm just saying. But it does. I mean, all these things sort of. Yeah. There is a dark side. It's like when people used to like put white. They would write the keyword over keyword spamming. They'd write the keyword over and over again in white type and put it on a white background, so Google would see it, and you'd initially get a bump in the rate in the SEO, but the user wouldn't see it except if they were colorblind and had made some change to their, like, or they were a low vision person and had said, "Always give me a black background," and then they would see all your spam. I mean, which again gets us back to, it's all a suggestion. Anytime we think we control it, we're just being very silly. The thing I wanted to say earlier, one of the problems in our industry, you were talking about making decisions about what technology stack you're going to use, what font stack, and so on. I think one of the problems in our industry, and I think it's attributable to some degree to, like you said, folks going to a boot camp, which gives them job skills and gets them out there, which is great, but they don't necessarily have background and grounding in some of the accessibility and usability things they should know. And so as a result, they'll say, "Well, I'm using this technology stack and it's for people." And they sort of assume that their technology stack is what everyone has. So, well, everyone's using this fast browser. Everyone has this fast connection. Everyone has a big screen like mine. Or I'm using JavaScript, therefore I completely control the experience and everyone will see what I want them to see because I'm doing the styling in JavaScript and I'm doing it. And they forget that, hey, this script might not load. This one script might not load and you get this blank page there. I don't think, and that's why you have people like Jeremy Keith going around telling everybody over and over again, finding different ways to say, yeah, it's called progressive enhancement for a reason. And if you put all your eggs in a JavaScript basket or in any kind of this one fragile technology basket, you may have no content at all.
Right.
All right, we need to take a very quick break to thank our sponsor, and then we will be back. And when I say very quick, I mean it'll probably take 20 minutes because I feel slow today. Today's big web show is brought to you by Dot Tech Domains, the new .tech domains. check it out. So one of the challenges faced by tech professionals and tech startups is finding the perfect domain name. You think of a name that seems perfect or is short and memorable and creative, and then it's already taken, or it's there. It's already been taken for .com and .org and .net, and it doesn't really help you at all. Well, luckily, there's this new .tech domain extension, which is meant specifically for the tech community. People like you and me and Jason Palmenthal. Tech domains provide three main benefits for startups. First, there's the availability of your first name, last name on .tech domains for your personal brand, like jeffreyzeldman.tech. I could have tomorrow, and I'm pretty sure nobody else has it, right? Secondly, there's the quality of the domain name. You don't have to compromise or settle for some less desirable domain name with hyphens or extra letters or extra numbers or sticking app at the end or sticking for you or some other nonsense at the end. You just pick the name you like and put .tech after it, and you're good. And thirdly, there's the relevance of the .tech extension to the tech industry. It's intuitive and descriptive, which helps you create a great first impression and really stand out in the crowd. Now, here are some examples of startup.tech domains. There's tanks.tech, a startup with $81 million raised in funding. There's brilliant.tech, a startup with $21 million raised in funding. Was it the .tech extension? I don't know, but they're doing pretty well. Libra.tech, a startup with $23 million raised in funding. Shadow.tech, a startup with $71.7 million raised in funding. These are all new brands that have created a great first impression and are clear about what kind of business they are just by picking that domain, the .tech domain. That big brands like it too. Viacom's portal for open source technology is called Viacom.tech, which clearly distinguishes it from its primary website. The Consumer Technology Association, a $292 billion U.S. consumer technology industry, is on CTA.tech. The Consumer Electronics Show, owned by CTA, actually moved from .org to .tech, as doing so helped make their online real estate, CES.tech, more relevant and brandable. And even Intel, we've all heard of them, uses Insight.tech for its portal for the Internet of Things and embedded innovation. Now, if you get a .tech domain, you can use it for your new tech startup or to create your tech blog or personal portfolio, or use it to define what your business or website's about. For example, breakinto.tech is a descriptive domain name for a business that's called breakintotech. And extreme.tech is a meaningful name that instantly creates a connect for the brand. That makes these names strong from the point of view of brand positioning. So, enough talk. Time to act. Go to get.tech and use code TBWS, that stands for the Big Web Show, to get 90% off on 1 and 5 year registrations. Normally for 1 year, it's $49.99, but with my code TBWS, it's only $4.99. 5 years is usually $250, but for you, with my code, it's only $24.99. So here's how it works. You go to www.get.tech and select a standard domain. Then at checkout, use coupon code TBWS. It's that simple. So thank you, .tech, and thank you, Jason Palmenthal. Here we are back doing the show. How you say it took you 2 years to write the book Responsive Typography?
Yeah, certainly not the writing didn't take. I mean, it's like a 100-page book, so I mean, thankfully, I write a little faster than that. But it was hard to get the focused time. And as it happens, it actually was a good thing that it was delayed enough for me to really hit upon that notion of scaling the type with the screen size, because that was actually something that came up in an article I was writing on the meantime, and I kind of fleshed that idea out in some talks and some experiments. So that actually became a pretty central part of the book and the whole premise. So I'm pretty okay with that, really, in the long run.
It does take a long time to write a book, and workshopping your ideas in articles, in talks, in experiments you do, you could be halfway through the book and suddenly have a profound realization that changes the intro and changes the structure, but for the better.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened. I mean, I changed the title. I changed the whole arc of it. I had always wanted it to be a useful book for sort of three different audiences, for graphic designers that didn't know the web, for web designers who didn't know typography, and front-end developers who needed to be able to implement it and do and understand a little bit of the why, but know how to do it technically well.
How do you address each of those groups in the book?
I start out at the very beginning and kind of let people know that it was sort of broken into chunks of like the first couple chapters is really about typography in general, and how it works and what it does, just sort of a very simple introduction, and then getting into I call it sort of like the four P's of responsive typography. There's proportion, performance. Now I'm not even going to remember the fourth one. Polish was the last one. But in any event, it was just sort of trying to get at the heart of why you would do this, how you would go about it, and what are the layers. Some of them is about making it work quickly. Some of it's about, you know, which is a lot of code. But then also from a design perspective, how you think through that experience. So styling the fallback fonts. I think that whole term flash of unstyled text, the only part of that that isn't a feature instead of a bug is right. The unstyled part. And it's only unstyled if you don't style it. Because there's been a way for us to target that fallback experience, or rather the experience that you see while the web fonts are loading. And so we want to get the content on screen in Georgia or Helvetic or Arial or whatever that is. But we can use a font loader like Font Face Observer from Bromstein, or prior to that, there was the Google Web Font Loader, which was a partnership between Typekit and Google, which I think Brom may have been involved in too. But that whole process gives you a class in your HTML tag that lets you sort of scope your CSS and make sure the fallbacks actually have a slightly modified font size, line height, spacing, so that the design kind of holds together in a similar manner. So
that's
that way,
genius. How did I not know about this?
Because that's... I didn't do a very good job publicizing it, because I wrote about that in 2011.
Oh my god!
And
because that's always been the problem, right? The line height will. That's why it seems right. like a bug, because the X height changes, the line height changes, and it just feels wrong.
Yep. And so you really only have to worry about the stuff that's at the top of the page, like navigation right. elements, maybe top level headings, and enough of the paragraph copy so that things generally stay in the same place. It's not the fact that the font changes that people notice or care about. It's that things move.
Right.
And so when right. line breaks change and like the spacing moves around, or your navigation all of a sudden wraps onto two lines because the fallbacks are a little bit bigger, you can tweak those things a little bit. And I just, so what I do is I create a little button with, that I can drop into the page template that will toggle the WF active and inactive classes. So I can then load the page, turn the web fonts off, style the fallback fonts a little bit just using the web inspector, and then toggle the web fonts on and off again until things aren't moving around. And that way, and you just copy that back into your style sheet, and there's your fallback styles. And that way it sort of addresses that whole process, and while the web fonts are loading, things kind of still stay in the same place.
There is a little extra code as a result, so you are adding that much weight to the page.
Well, but you're adding, the net is you're adding, a couple dozen lines of CSS, and that's it.
In return, you're having a page that doesn't make you nauseous.
Right.
And what's the browser? It was a Safari, I think, always... it didn't do unstyled text. It just waited until the fonts loaded. Remember that?
Oh, it was terrible. It was awful.
Do they still do that?
No. They were the first browser to do that. They would basically not render anything until the web font loaded, and initially they had no timeout. And it was so it would just wait around forever with this blank yes. screen and some random underlines in the middle of it.
There was I remember a beautiful angry rant by someone. It was it wasn't about that though. It was about something else. But they were like saying like, here's how to do design on the web. They were really telling you. It was very prescriptive what good design on the web was. And they were, I think, serving it from their own machine, which was under their desk. Like their web host was their own Linux box under their desk. And their mom was vacuuming and that to hurt the power. I don't know what the problem was, but it took like 3 minutes. And you'd see the bullet points. Right. You'd just look at the bullet points and right. you'd see underlines. And then after a while, you would get like a subhead. Right. And it was just crazy. It yeah. was so fun. I would just take screenshots of it. And I'm not mean, so I wouldn't send it to the person. But I was just thinking, you're not helping your cause at all if you're trying to tell people how to design. Because this, yeah. this is like the worst experience I can imagine. And of course, their browser didn't do that. So right. they had no idea.
Yeah. And so there have been a few things that have happened since then. So what all the browsers have done is adopt a 3-second timeout. And so it'll wait around to see if the web font loads for 3 seconds. If it doesn't, then it will put up the content in the fallback font. And what I wanted to do is like skip the 3 seconds. I want the fallbacks there immediately so that you can read the text. And by using this little trick with the WF active and inactive stuff, if you put that JavaScript that does that work in line in the head of the page, it happens super quick. And that way you can get that content displayed and styled right away. And then when the web font loads, it's sort of like a JPEG coming into focus, you know, where it sort of like progressively loads and then you know, it's a little fuzzy and then it gets better. And so your content loads, you can read it, and then it sort of shifts into the web font, but nothing really moves. So if you started to read it, it's not that much of a disruption. And that, you know, I think was, I think the most significant thing for me in making web fonts an acceptable experience early on, and then couple that with the proportion scaling across different screen sizes, and then you've got a really usable way of incorporating it that doesn't get in the way of the user experience. There have been other things that have come along. So we've got font display. So you can, in your at font face declarations now, you can tell the browser that you want it to swap right away, or you can tell it you want to wait if that's what you prefer to do. But that I usually just by default, I'll tell it to swap. So any browser that supports that, it will immediately go to the fallback font and then only change it once I tell it to, once the font's
loaded. Do all the modern browsers support that?
I don't think so. I confess I have not gone back to check. I use that in conjunction with Font Face Observer. So to me, it doesn't really matter if it works or not. I think it's just another enhancement. It's another layer that I put in there. But I use Font Face Observer to try and quickly get it into the fallback font. And then once that sort of class switch happens and the web fonts are active, then it would go back into the sort of the intended design.
What if you're not a professional web designer or interaction designer, if you're a teacher who needs to make a website or a blogger who needs to make their own website, what should, that's not many people who listen to the show. Most people who listen to the show do what we do. But if you're somebody like that, what should they know about this? Or should they not know anything? Is it too complicated?
I would like them to know more. And I think, you know, there are the beginnings of the tools to help people with this. I don't think the platforms are doing enough yet to put it into practice. So, you know, those are the sorts of friends and relatives and clients that I've talked to that I would recommend go to WordPress.com, go to Squarespace, go to Wix. They have, or Snowfire if you're over in Europe, or well, really anywhere, but they've got a cool platform too. And you can pick a nice looking theme, you can customize things, you can pick web fonts and add them. And services like Typekit have, and fonts.com have long been adding those classes during the loading process, but by default, to my knowledge, none of these online systems are already using that in order to provide a better experience. It's sort of still on you to do something with it. And so that's something that I'd love to see change, is to actually raise the level of awareness about this with those platforms.
Now, this is... Yes.
Yeah. So that their themes out of the box could take advantage of this and get text on screen and have some base work done to style things to go along with those web fonts. But that is something to help that requires the person, some intervention. But, you know?
Well, you're doing it now because we're talking about it. Right? And we can talk about it to people at WordPress and Squarespace and places like that. And does Typekit, is there something that they can do to help with this? Or
they do a lot
behind the scenes.
They could. And actually, I mean, I'm fortunate that having been doing this for a while, when I said, hey, I'm going to quit my agency job, you know, back in May, and I said, I'm going to go back to working on my own and I want to focus on typography and helping companies do this stuff better. One of the wonderful things that happened was I found myself the week after I left Isovera, which is a great agency. I really enjoyed being there, but it wasn't the right place for me to stay. The following week, I was out in San Francisco at Adobe's in-house like Typekit internal conference, talking to them about this stuff, and so they have a goal of making type more accessible to more people. It's always been their goal, but yes. You know, with Adobe, I think that, you know, naturally widens that lens.
Yes.
And what I think is so interesting about this is, and I want to be respectful. I don't want to say anything out of school with their plans, but I don't think I'm really saying anything that you can't easily infer. If they want to help more people use type, then what you want to do is not introduce more things that they have to worry about in order to do it successfully. So
right.
The system should take care of more of that.
And other people that have businesses like this, like Heffler's cloud photography, same mm-hmm. thing. You can buy the fonts and host them yourself, but certain problems won't be solved for you. Or you can let them do it, and they solve a lot of problems. So you can host stuff yourself, but if you host with Typekit, you can subset things, and you can kind of do it that dynamically.
Right.
There's lots of stuff that you can do.
Yeah, and you know, I think the opportunity, and this is a big ask, because you know Typekit's a big company; they have a lot of customers. But I think that's where then the big value would come into play, is if I use Typekit to set my type, and you know, you can do that in your kit. You can say, I want to use this typeface for this selector, you know, for H1s, for H2s. If you're picking your font stack there, and here's my web font, and here's what I want as a fallback, then there might be a way to sort of programmatically create those style sheets to give a baseline slightly better experience and then allow customization from there. And I think so that would be a way that you could enable better typography across all these devices through all scenarios. And you know, again, that's sort of it's kind of a premium service, but you solve it once there at a platform level, and you've solved it or enabled it for millions of people. And I think that's where you move the web forward and things like that. And that's what's really interesting to me is to try and work at these things at that sort of platform level to enable it for huge portions of population rather than just one company at a time.
That is very interesting to me. I have a question that's related to that. You're talking about what Adobe could do, what Typekit could do. There are other, or there have been other type tools for designers. Text.
Well, Typecast.
Yes.
Yes.
Although I don't hear as much from them lately, and I don't know that they're.
Unfortunately, the platform is being sunsetted, which is really unfortunate.
It's very unfortunate.
Yeah.
It's very freeing. to have a sort of quasi WYSIWYG type, like, you might want to go recode it later. You will, yeah. but it's amazing to, like, you know, to have, or just to have little, these little starter kits. Again, talking yeah. about how to help maybe younger designers or people who aren't, you know, who are developers first, designers second, or graphic designers who aren't that skilled at coding, but, you know, but have, are greatly skilled at type layout. It was a, I mean, I've used it and with phenomenal results to me, to just like setting up a page to be readable. Just making, you know, using type yeah. conservatively, but, you know, economically, right. but with visual richness.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what I loved is, and, you know, for people who haven't seen Typecast, it allows you to make type prototypes. And, you know, so you can create this column of text with different elements. And it had, and what I loved about it was it had fonts from many foundries.
Yes.
So it wasn't just Adobe. It wasn't just Monotype. It wasn't just any one thing. I mean, at the time they had stuff when FontDeck was still around, which was an amazing service.
Yes.
Google Web Fonts. They had like stuff from all these different providers so that you weren't working on something that locked you into one particular platform. And then you could play around with different widths and different proportions. So you could kind of mock it up. Like, here's my proportions for desktop. Here's my proportions for right. phone. And then export all of that together. And it was a really great prototyping platform just for typography.
And it used the web. I mean, you can yes, do that now in Sketch.
Right.
And you can do it now in the new version of XD. You can do some responsive things and play around with, but not to this degree, and not right. where you actually have CSS yeah, this, as an end product, HTML and CSS.
Right.
Again, well, you may want to rewrite it, but you have a real head start.
Yeah, and you know what it will actually look like in a browser. Because yeah. that's, you know, that like type rendering is something that is just different. It's not going to be the same when you look at it in Mac and Windows and different browsers. They all do things slightly differently.
And if you can remember comping in Photoshop
yes.
and showing it to the client, Photoshop used to say, they used to give you four different ways of rendering the type, none of which would be what the browser would do, all of which were interesting. Right. And you could go like, well, I like this. It's really soft. I like this crisp one, but it's a little jaggedy, but it's really crisp and easy to read. This one's a little harder to read, but it looks less terrible. And none of them are what, right. and then each browser would do a different thing. And then on each platform, and even yeah. on different screens. And so, you know, a lot of people, I've heard Brad Frost say it, a lot of people say this, I don't know who originated it, but Photoshop is a great way to show the client what the design will absolutely never look exactly like.
Well, I was actually trying to come up with who originated the phrase. It's, you know, it's a nice picture of a website,
yes.
but it's not a website.
Dan Moll, I've heard say that. He say we sell websites yeah. like paintings.
Right.
Like, and it's true. And when I look at people's portfolios, a lot of times I'm like, this doesn't tell me anything. And when I used to judge occasionally, they would ask me to be one of the many judges at a, you know, like for communication arts or the art directors club or something, judging websites. We were really looking at paintings, and I go, this, I have no idea what this experience is like. I don't know if it feels like it responds to my, it's like showing me a picture of a piano. And saying, right. is this the best piano? I don't know. I don't know how it responds to my fingers. I haven't played it, so I don't really know. It looks pretty. Looks prettier than a Steinway. Is it as good as a Steinway? I don't know. Looking at pictures of websites in like award books and making decisions. That's how we judge it for like the first 10 years. Well, not always by choice.
Right.
Kicking and screaming. In fact, Dan Moll and I did one of those together. And it was just like, I remember asking, is this Flash or HTML? And someone said, what does it matter? What difference does it make? And I was just like, okay, that's where we are.
Right.
You know, and to me, it makes all the difference in the world. And to Dan, same, but not that one's better than the other or one's good and one's bad, but just, I want to know what I'm looking at and I right. don't. Anyway, why do you think Typecast, I wish, like, this is where I wish I was rich and could just buy stuff that should live forever. I wish I could just buy Typecast and just go keep it going.
Yeah, I think
did they not have enough customers to cover their expenses?
At one point, they started out as a an independent startup. Then they were acquired by Monotype, and I think it was difficult to find the right business model.
Okay, so it's like Gowalla. Gowalla gets bought by Facebook and instantly dies. Like when a big company buys a small, plucky company. Typekit being the exception. Typekit being the company that helped transform Adobe almost as much as Adobe transformed Typekit.
I certainly think so.
Yeah. But most of the time,
Yeah, I don't know really. I think it was a tricky one, I think, from the beginning, even when it was on its own. I paid to use it, but I think, we've got all these different tools and it had its very specialized purpose. What I would hope, and I haven't been back to play with Figma in a while, but like a tool like that would be an ideal one to kind of pick up where Typecast left off, and in the context of a web-based UX design tool, to be able to prototype your type there. I mean, it's one of the things that I'll routinely do is I'll make it's like a typography harness page when we're trying to evaluate typefaces for a project so that I can show people different web pages that are responsive. But it's, that's my sort of cheap, recreation of what I used to be able to do with Typecast so that we could look at them, see how they look, see how we like them, how do they look at different devices and different screen sizes and whatnot.
Now you can still log into Typecast. They're not supporting it, but so it's still, you should be able to use it in some fashion.
Yeah. I think that will sort of increasingly, become more brittle. The article that I wrote for them about that sort of modular scale across screen sizes was the thing that totally changed the direction of my book. And I think right now the only place that article lives is on their blog. So I might need to find out about getting that somewhere else.
I used to write for Adobe, and then Adobe used to have a very vigorous content side. Their website used to be a place you would go to read about Hillman Curtis and all this other amazing people and stuff and ideas. And then suddenly you'd buy something. You don't know how, but you bought something because they were entertaining you and instructing you in your craft. And now they don't do that. I always think if a company can have a blog and really make a difference, it's great. It's a big part of the service that you provide. Typekit is great at that with Tim Brown and just, So in the time that remains, which is not much, we've talked about some about the history of the type on the web, and what are some exciting things you're looking forward to now? What are some things you're working on without violating confidentiality?
Yeah, sure. Variable fonts has definitely been the big focus of my speaking and writing and sort of professional exploration, and that is something that I'm increasingly bullish about. I really think that it is going to transform the way we think about design on the web. And I think it's going to be hugely important for branding and communications, but also performance and user experience, because beyond all of the basics of width and weight and italics, you've got I've got this typeface called Bello that from Underwear that they showed in Antwerp, and I'll actually get to show in a couple weeks at Nevada Park in Orlando, where the axis is time. You can write in, but the text exists. So when you think about it from an accessibility standpoint, it's there, but visually, I really love how this plays with the ideas that Jen Simmons has been talking about, the relationship between cinematography and film and the web.
Yes.
So things over time that draw you in, And that's actually part of the way I want to show these things visually at the conference through the talk is actually things in motion. And we can do all of that without sacrificing readability. If people want to turn that off, they can. It's still understood by machines in the same way. So that's really fascinating to me. I also had the chance to talk to some really brilliant people, Jeremy Mickel, fantastic designer, and Leon Amos from Adidas, about how they're using variable fonts in print. And that's really fascinating to me. There's more to this than just the web. In thinking about the versatility of a typeface for brand communication, when you can customize it, if you think about what Paula Scher and Pentagram did for the New School with that typeface design, that was sort of an early thought about how you might achieve that level of differentiation visually in a variable font. If you could do that now, you'd have a whole different way of working with that. And that's really fascinating to me, to sort of open up the visual language at the same time to allow for things like better usability for someone who has low vision, being able to toggle the grade of the text and make it a stronger contrast, or react to user environment when it's dark and you could sort of increase the contrast.
Right, like phones do.
Right, exactly. So tying that into, and I was actually just, Mandy Michael has been doing a ton of really great experiments with variable fonts, and she and I were just kind of going back and forth a little bit today about the light sensing API. Is unfortunately, it was implemented in Firefox, and I think they may have pulled it because nobody else was implementing it. But having that light sensing API available in the browser, allowing you to react to ambient light and increase or decrease the contrast between the back foreground and background so the text gets more readable, that's absolutely user experience.
So, as a web person, I've got to say that our dream that everything would happen in the browser, it's eventually going to come to pass. It's taken a lot of innovation. It's taken a lot of struggle. Like when we said that, when Netscape and Sun got together and said, "Oh, Microsoft's dead. Everything's going to happen with Java in Netscape." No, that was not. But the dream that everything could happen and be served to everyone, regardless of their platform, that it all happened on the web in the browser. I think we're going to see that in our lifetime. And I think it's very exciting.
Yeah. Well, and that's, some other experiments that I've been doing lately are just about the reading experience itself. And how can we, because we can do lots of great typography. We can react to screen size, but replicating the experience of reading a book is hard. But with CSS multi-column and viewport units, with a couple lines of CSS, you can actually turn a chapter into a series of screens full of content automatically. So we need to layer in a few other techniques to have it respond to touch better and use scroll snap and a bunch of these other things that are evolving in CSS, where we could dynamically create a more book-like experience. And some people might say, well, why do you want to? Because it's natural to me. When I pick up a tablet and I look at stuff, one of the things
Absolutely.
That I loved, the first iteration of the New York Times iPad app that Koivin worked on, it scrolled sideways. It was this tremendously natural swipe, to kind of move through like the article.
And the Washington Post still does that on the iPad, and it's great.
Yeah, and so like that's, I think there are natural modes of interaction that we're starting to have these things pull together, and we might need to, layer in a little bit of JavaScript to smooth out the experience, but I don't think that's necessarily wrong either.
No.
Just to kind of create these analog connections between, or analogous kind of connections between something physical that we're used to, but reinvent it in a digital way.
It's parallel. It's parallel with when you're progressively enhancing and you're saying, okay, then this this is still a URL and you're changing from one URL to another URL. So people with simple technology at their disposal will see traditional web pages going from one to another.
Right.
But for someone with JavaScript and a fast connection, they may see a modal or they may see a screen wipe or something, and that's great and that'll be fun for them and it's appropriate in this context. but it doesn't, it's not where we made this thing in JavaScript. And if you don't have the right browser and you don't have JavaScript, you're not going to see it. It's where everybody sees something.
Yeah.
Do you remember TreeSaver? Roger Black's experiment from at the same time as responsive web design. And I think what hurt it was publishers either wanted to put all their eggs in Apple's basket, or they wanted to go with responsive web design, and they didn't understand the value. I think TreeSaver had a lot of value. It was an amazing combination of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to make a real magazine or newspaper experience on a tablet, which feels natural.
Yeah. Oh, and I think that's some of the things that we're still missing in a web experience. You get from the physicality of a catalog, a magazine, a book, being able to take in many things at once and zoom in on the thing that's of interest to you. That scanning and browsing is still, it's still hard to approximate that in a good way. You know, I think tiny little, you know, a grid of cubes is not the right answer. You know, I don't think it's very compelling. I don't think it's very interesting. One of the things that I showed in at my Event Apart talk in Seattle was sort of reimagining a magazine or the Wall Street Journal. You know, what can a newspaper do to have a more dynamic feel in an editorial design standpoint on the web? And CSS Grid and content management systems and variable fonts can all kind of come together there to allow that. We just need to remember how much more interesting it can be, and why people are still buying books and why people are still buying magazines, because they are. And it's because we're not, I mean, well, for a lot of reasons, but one, I don't think that we're really providing that much more compelling an experience on the web beyond convenience. So I'd pay for a subscription to whatever that magazine is, if it was a great layout and it got me something else, maybe. You know, if I've given them a subscription, maybe I shouldn't have so many ad tracking scripts, and then there's a net gain. So there's a reason for me to give them my money.
And there's no tracking in a print magazine.
Right. You know, I mean, there's nothing that's slowing me down from turning that page. I turn the page and I instantly get the content. And, you know, we want to make sure that we can provide that similar kind of experience.
I've loved talking with you today. I look forward to seeing your presentation at an Event Apart Orlando. It's a rainy, miserable day in our part of the country, so try to enjoy staying home and working on stuff. Thank you very much for your time today. Our show page will list all the URLs we've talked about, and Jason, thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you.
Pleasure having you. We'll do it again soon, I hope, because there's obviously lots to talk about.
There is. I'd love to.
Great. And folks, this has been The Big Web Show. See you again soon.